Last time we talked to Lucy Barnhard, she told us about some of the challenges of getting from one country to the other, some of the fun times she had, the interesting food challenges she was met with. Well, now we're going to hear about some of the other challenges and some scary places and situations she was in, as well as what it was like to hike with her dog, Wombat. Let's hear what she has to say. So Lucy Barnhard, welcome back to part two to this interview. Lucy is the first woman to hike the entire length of South America. She's also attempting to hike the entire length of the Earth. She started out at the tip of South America, and she's hiking towards the tip of Alaska. Lucy, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, we left off so many more questions I wanted to ask. So let's dive into the one that's like on the top of my head. I asked about animal encounters, but how about places? Any places where you felt unsafe or it was just a little scary for you?
Yeah, there's a number of occasions where I have felt. There's one place where I really felt fear, but there's also been some high risk areas that I passed through. I think if we start chronologically, in my first week, I was in a national park where it's protected, but it's not hiked. And to open it up, they're building a road. And so this road is going to take about 10 years to build because the wilderness is so dense in this region. And I didn't know that they were doing that. And when I passed through, I could hear explosions going off. So they were detonating the mountain to clear way for this road to be built. And I don't know how close I can get to explosives before I'm putting myself at risk. And so that was really one of the first times where I had to use my beacon to write to somebody back home who is well adapted in managing high risk areas and able to research and let me know, you know, if you're on the next mountain, you're fine, but don't go any further than the bottom of the mountain that's being detonated. And so I had to then reroute myself and ensure that I was keeping a distance away from this area. And then there are things as simple as human interference. So because I'm a female on my own passing through cultures that are typically very patriarchal and chauvinistic at times, I will often encounter men who not only ask me questions, but feel very entitled to the answer and my time, and become physically frustrated if I don't give them the responses that they want. And so over time, I have learned to tell people that, of course, I'm not walking on my own. My husband is in the next town. And then some local people taught me that my husband is from whatever close city is nearby, so that the threat of said husband is a real threat to them. It's not just a foreigner, you know. So passing through Colombia, my husband was from Medellin because that's a notorious area for, you know, the underworld. And just the thought of me being associated with that and them becoming entwined was threatening. So the first time that I had men harass me was south of Chile, south of Santiago, and there were two occasions, one where a man was probably not quite mentally sound and he just kept trying to get my attention and touch me and push me around. And that was the first time where it's on the cusp of being in a populated area. So I just stepped out onto a road and stopped all traffic and said, I'm not moving until someone deals with this person. And it's amazing how in these cultures there is nothing worse than being inconvenienced. And so as soon as the people are unable to do whatever it is they need to do, men get involved quickly and solve the problem for me. And that was exactly what I did the next time it happened, when a group of men tried to force me into the car with them. And obviously I'm explaining that I'm walking and I can't go in a car, and they were being highly sinister and trying to take me. So I stopped a whole bus and traffic on both sides of a main, like not a highway, but it was the main road. And then they just tried to pretend that they were asleep and that they were never talking to me in the first place. So I stood there and I said, until that car has gone, I'm not allowing anyone to come past on this road. And again, the community of people helped me get rid of these people. But also, you know, I don't turn up to town without intentionally making sure that I don't use, you know, I don't turn up on the weekend when people could be drinking. Or if I do turn up on the weekend, I turn up at 4 in the morning, 5, 6 in the morning, when the markets are getting ready and opening and there are women around, so that I can start chatting to these women and looking like I'm affiliated within the community. And so people are going to be less likely to try and interfere with me. So these are the warm-ups of getting used to the threats that can occur, but aren't by any means the end of it. You know, battling a snowstorm on my own and accidentally setting up camp in a tunnel under the road that's the known den of a puma was probably also not my best move.
Wow.
Yeah. And then to continue, I mean, there's so many examples, but I've just recently passed through Colombia and I went, I wanted to take a route that was recommendable, but then I found out from the police that one of their friends had been assassinated through that zone and it was really hot right now. And if I went through there, I would be taken by guerrillas and had to reroute. So I did, but then it pushed me along an area that should have been fine, except that the maps that I used to take a shortcut and walk through the more pretty area put me through an armed gang, an area that's just known for that and where you will be robbed and you may go missing. And so in that scenario, a group of women pulled me aside and I just knew by the way that they were trying to get me to talk to them that there was something I had to pay attention to, all of this in foreign language. So they said that it's a boiling pot and that I can't go through there. And they understood, they knew that I was following a GPS because obviously they've stopped people before. And they said I had to go back to the Pan America, which was it meant that I had to walk 50 kilometers that day, which was just like, I mean, my legs felt like they were going to just fall off my torso. And by the time I got to the Pan American Highway, they had sent their male family members to ensure that they blocked my way physically from entering into this boiling pot, because it's not if, you know, you cannot go in here. So 3 times they stopped me from passing through this zone, and then they'd called the police, and the police turned up when I got to the Pan American Highway and they said, what are you doing? Can't you get a bus like normal people? And I was like, well, no, this is what I'm doing. And they said, okay, we can give you an escort. We'll drive behind you. And I was like, really? That would be amazing. Because, you know, there's so many times in this journey where I've hit a funnel in my hike and I have to go this way or I will have a gap in the walk. But then someone has enabled me rather than just saying no. I mean, that is just magical on its own. So I said to them, look, let me put my dog in the back of your car because it's now 2 o'clock. We haven't had a break and it's the hottest time of day and he is going to have a meltdown at any moment. So if he can ride in the back, then I'll walk faster and get through this part and it'll be better for everyone. So I got him in the back of the car, but he kept barking. So I went back to the car and I just said to them, look, I'm going to have to talk firmly with this dog to get him to calm down. And if I tell him to go to bed, he knows that the time of his protest has come to an end. So I try to get him to lie down, but there's something on the chair in the back of the police car that's like stopping him from getting settled. So I reach my arm into the police car and I'm like, permiso, which is like, excuse me, like, forgive me, all in one. And what I move is a grenade launcher. So we're like in serious territory here. And suddenly, you know, when you get that cold, tingly feeling down your spine and you really realize that you are in the jaw of something that's going to like not have a nice result, that's what I was experiencing. So I set off and I have never in my life walked 6 kilometers in 30 minutes, but that day I did. It was like
You weren't in an area where it was just street crimes. You were in a war zone, almost.
Yeah, and yet, at least in this area, unlike the one I described previously where there's gorillas, the police presence is permitted. So they can be there, and they explained this to me afterwards, which I kind of wish they'd said beforehand, is that with them behind me, I was safe. If they weren't there, I was not safe. So yes, it can be really delicate, these environments that I'm passing through, and usually I'd be far more better researched and equipped to pass through, but I'd been guided by the police, who are really trustworthy in Colombia. You can take their guidance and know that it's assured, but at some point that area had just gone lapsed the attention of the people that were guiding me, when really they had probably just assumed that I knew, because later I talked to people who are locals who can list all of the areas in Colombia where you just don't go, and that is one of them. So, but then the community of people who live in these regions are so loving, and they look after each other so nicely, that even a white girl walking through who's a tourist and clueless is going to be protected, and they're going to do their best to look after you, and they genuinely care. And as you can tell, because this group of women nested around me, and then they sent their male family members to protect me and guard me and ensure that I didn't go down the wrong road. So that's magical.
Yeah, you know, people are living in under such violent circumstances, with such a willingness to help a foreigner, somebody foreign to their land. It just shows you, yeah, you know, the kindness that's still there. There's, you know, amongst all this violence, there's kindness there. There's people there that are, yeah, still willing to do kind things for people.
Oh, yeah. And Colombia is nothing like what you see on television. The majority of, you know, someone said to me, the best and worst thing about Colombia is the same thing, and it's the people. The majority of people are wonderful, and there are a lot of people, a lot of foreigners who live there, because you can get a two-year visa, work from home with a job that you have in the country that you come from, and live there. It's beautiful, and the culture and the community is something that you'll get sucked into, so much so that you'll be quickly looking for a reason why the government should allow you to stay there permanently. It is enriching. The coffee is brilliant. The chocolate's delicious. And their festivals are just something that you never want to leave. They really know how to live a beautiful, intentional life. However, they have been at war with themselves for a century. And so, yes, that's something that they're still navigating and trying to iron out. And I mean, it really comes down to entitlement of the few. So I would live there happily, but now I also know where I won't live.
one of my sons visited Colombia. He said it is a beautiful country, but there's parts of it that are just very, very dangerous. And he's traveled around the world, and he says, you know, every city, including here in the United States, despite what a lot of us think that live here, we have cities that are dangerous, parts of cities that are dangerous. And a lot of it's just knowing where to go and where not to go.
Exactly. Local knowledge.
All right.
Yeah. And so moving on from that experience, that is still not the worst or most dangerous area that I've passed through. So I have just come out of what's known as the Darien Gap, and not many people can cross this area, but many people do out of desperation. So the Darien Gap is about a 70-kilometer gap in the Pan American Highway that is separated by jungle that's impassable, and has never really been developed because of the protection to environment, which is wonderful, but also because of the human trafficking, the drug trafficking, and the general criminality that exists in there. And there are guerrillas who are stationed there, and certainly it used to be the base of FARC, which is a very well-known anti-establishment political party that had been very active. I mean, some people would use the word terrorist activity for a very, very long time, until there was a treaty reached, but it's very delicate, and it comes in and out. But this area is a hot zone. It's a red zone by all countries. You do not travel here but I needed to pass through. So I did my due diligence. I spoke to many people. I found out who were the people I needed to talk to, who were the people I don't talk to. I needed to make sure that the traffickers and the coyotes didn't know where I was or who I was and that I was intending to pass through, because I would have been targeted. I met with the Indigenous groups who own the land through these zones to make sure that I could pass through with a guide as safely as possible. And I had to accept that there was a 90% chance that I would be robbed. So I needed to take things that I was willing to have stolen and be ready to prepare to have all of my items replaced, which is exactly what I have done, and am now waiting for my gear mule to turn up to replenish equipment. But what happened is I turned up, I got my passport stamped, and I passed into Panama. And now in this, now that I'm in that area, I've passed through the red zone and I'm now back into an amber zone. However, I was a little bit confused about some communication that I had with where my fixer lived, and I thought that for the night I'd be resting in that first town rather than going forward. And in that time, even though I'd been stamped through and permitted to continue with a guide, they then started talking and coming to understand that this single female from a developed country where there is swing of the government is going to try and pass through the Darien Gap on her own, more or less, but with guides, and that if I weren't missing, the heat and pressure from my government would, you know, not only be really difficult for them to navigate, but also they would be the ones responsible for finding me. And they don't want people going missing. They care about humanity and the lives of the people that come in to visit their country. So, I got to that first little village where I was going, and I was volunteering because, you know, among the darkness, this is a nesting area for an endangered species of turtle, the leatherback turtle, and it was really special. And I was, because I'm so experienced at hiking, I could walk all night and help them locate turtles to then conduct the first project where they tag them to learn about their migratory habits. So I was doing that and giving back and working with scientists when I was contacted by the boss of Border Patrol, who was talking to me, not directly, but through my contact and through anyone else other than him, and saying that if I continue, they would deport me. And that is a showstopper, because if I'm deported from a country, that's the end of my expedition. And so because I'd been volunteering with these scientists, they happened to know his boss and invited me to participate in a meeting with them when they reached Panama. So I jumped onto their private plane, it turned up to the city, knew that I couldn't argue with the people on the border because they had set their mind to say no, and there was nothing, you know, when you meet someone and they just absolutely are not saying anything other than no, because they put their, you know, especially because they've put their foot down and that's the end of it. So I held on to faith and met with the Director General of the Border Patrol and Security here in Panama, was introduced to him as a woman who is attempting to be the first woman to walk the length of the earth and has battled through 11,000 kilometres to get to Panama and is now at a crossroad. Can we help her? And he sat back and looked at me and said, "Of course, we'll send you an armed escort." Just like that. So over the next week, I prepared and got my equipment ready and all of my food supplies, returned to this same very small village, and with Centrefront, which is the national border control and enforcement, I set off with seven armed men who carry two pistols and a machine gun and rocket launchers to walk through the most dangerous, one of what's considered to be one of the most dangerous places in the world.
We'll be back after a quick break. You ever think about what might be in the water you're drinking every time you fill up your water bottles while you're in the outdoors? I try not to, and I really don't because I use Sawyer water filters. Sawyer filter technology, because of their high standards, every filter is individually tested 3 times through the process. I've been using their permethrin product for years now to protect me from, well, quite frankly, ticks, and the picaridin to keep the flies at bay. Don't let bad water, insects, or a tick bite cut your trip short or even ruin it. Use Sawyer products. Go to your local outdoor retailer and ask for Sawyer products, whether it's a water filter, insect repellent, they're likely to have it. You can also go to Sawyer's website and read more about these incredible, high quality products that they offer those of us who enjoy the outdoors.
When you started this, or when you were like taking that, when you were back home thinking of this, did it cross your mind at all that you might not just need like a police escort, but like a military escort along part of your journey?
Yeah, I mean, I knew that there were areas that would be hot that I would have to be leaning on diplomacy to assist. But I also knew that I had no experience through hiking, and I really just thought, let's just see how far I can get, and anything's worth celebrating. The more people that try this, the more we're going to learn, and the more chance that someone is going to be able to become the first woman to do it. So that's what I was leaning on. I really didn't think I'd get to this point. And I also knew clearly, I mean, you mentioned Daring Gap to anyone who's heard of it, and they're going to want to explain to you everything that they know, which isn't really the truth of it ever. And how you're not going to be able to do it because you won't be able to cross through this zone. And the truth is that there are, before the pandemic, 20,000 people were crossing this crossing every year. Post-pandemic, with desperation and people's lives, you know, on the brink of the tipping point of anything that's livable, there are now 200,000 people crossing every year. That's like more than 500 people a day. So there are more than one crossings. There's areas where it's safer, areas where it's you just have to accept that what happens to you is what happens. And if you come through with your life, then you have an opportunity to be able to live one that's better on the other side, and that risk is worth it. And it is so such a shame for me to think that not everyone has the crossing that I had. And it was in no means not dangerous. I mean, there were many times when the guns went off and we had to go into formation and prepare for encountering people that were either drug trafficking or trafficking arms or any number of things. But I have to say, take my hat off to the Panama government, because anybody who turns up, who are coming from a country of conflict, who arrive to the villages where they are finally safe, are processed by the government and are then chaperoned by boat to the Pan-American Highway, and then are put onto to buses. And 20 buses every day leave the jungle to carry these people to Costa Rica, where they can then continue their journey to seek a safe place to live. And they're met with love and care and respect, and I get emotional talking about it because it's just so incredible to see the love and compassion. because people have AIDS and are sick and need help, and they get it. They get it from the government and from the aid agencies, and it's just remarkable that I can be doing such privileged walk that sometimes feels irrelevant, and that people are doing it because they have to.
That's very moving. And that's one of the questions I wanted to ask, is you were out there. We hear about the refugees. Not every country is exactly very welcoming or treats them well.
No, and you know, even from Australia, we've had hard measures because it's from a standpoint of protecting lives. When people are risking their lives to arrive, for example, by boat to Australia. But these the treatment and the reason, the approach and the culture and the attitude towards refugees is that they're immigrants and that they're trying to take something that they shouldn't, they have no right to take, when what they're taking is they're trying to survive. They're desperate. They're hanging off a cliff with their fingernails and they just want to be able to climb up onto stable ground, you know, like, and we in our life experience truly will never understand the true fear that they live with. And, you know, it's not maybe someone in their family will die. Many members of their family have been torn from them because they were born in a country where there's corruption and instability.
Yeah, as you said, you have your backpack and your gear and you've made a decision. You're going to walk through these countries. But something I've always thought about when I hear about refugee stories is, like you said, they're not doing this by choice. How much fear is driving them that they're making this journey, risking their lives, leaving with, in many cases, nothing but the clothing on their back just to get to a safer place?
Yeah, and these people are passing through the Darien Gap knowing that they're going to be robbed, that the women are going to be raped, that they could be mutilated, and that risk is worth it.
You would think a civilized country would get it, would understand that people that are that motivated to get from one place to the next, to leave their country, to risk that much, there has to be some compassion. How can we not have compassion for that?
And what's really sickening is that the people who are most opposed are the people who are most outspoken when they feel like they aren't given what they're entitled to and they're not assisted when they need it, when they're desperate.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. I agree with you 100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and it must have been very heart-wrenching for you. I mean, you know, and I could tell, you know, it's very emotional for you, but to witness that.
Yeah, it's hard. It's really hard, but it's also important. And I do say, you know, this walk is something that's very decadent and it's a privilege. And in the scale of importance in the world, it's completely irrelevant. And yet it's not, because I'm able to shed light and open these conversations. And I've been given an opportunity to really show something that rarely makes public eye.
Mm-hmm. Right. We often see it through the lens of the news. And unfortunately, there's always an angle and it's never a positive mm-hmm. one. And like you said, mm-hmm. They're playing to our fears. They're coming here to take something from us. You know, I just would hope that if I was in that situation where I had to flee my country with just the clothing on my back, knowing that my children, my family could be killed, my children could be raped, et cetera, that there'd be somebody on the other side with some kindness to help me, that somebody on the other side of this would have some compassion.
And can I tell you, this has been happening for years. There, and I mean it, 20 buses every day are heading out of the jungle after these people have survived God knows what. And yet I'm walking and people are thinking, she doesn't look like she's immigrating, but we're going to stop and check and see if she needs help. So the Panamanian people have still got the love and the care and the humanity to check and give me water or Gatorade or ask me, do you need a ride? Can we help you get to where you want to go? And it makes me feel shame that they have that generosity still after years of an area of their country being hostile and having to help people. They're still willing to share their meal, open their homes, put people in their cars and help them seek the safety that they're searching for. And yet we're from countries that are so privileged and so well developed, and so many people still have blinkers over their eyes and are just completely disinterested because they're not willing to share what they have on their plate, which is usually far more than they need.
My country wastes more food, and I think they somebody did a study, than all the countries combined in the world, throws more food out. But don't let a desperate refugee cross the border and have something. Don't, there's places you're not allowed to even leave water out for people crossing the border.
And even so, like one thing that I've really noticed through this expedition is that we do this thing where we point fingers, which is, you know, it's fine to reflect and be like, you know, why aren't our countries doing more? When what we really need is for people to put their hand up and start saying, okay, this may not be my problem, this may not be my fault, but I have a solution or I can contribute to it.
Yeah, absolutely. What can I do to help this situation? Mm. Is there anything I can do to make this better?
Yeah, because with the right people or with enough people, it's not that far away. It's really, truly, it's in arm's reach.
Well, seeing this kindness in Panama, does it give you any hope that maybe that can spread? That, you know, if people living in an area like that, where they're living this every day, could that spread to maybe more of us just getting it? No other better way to put it, I think, than to just say getting what the crisis is, getting how desperate these people are, that they're human beings. They deserve our help, our intention, our attention to help get them to safety.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as though there's a utopia where we can just provide a bit of land for people to move to and hope that they'll be okay. But also, let's, for an example, I mean, there are people coming from all different countries. It's not just one. But if we talk about any particular country that is, you know, living with corruption and unrest, there has to be a diplomatic way for this, that it can't go on. You know, it's been happening for a really long time, but surely at some point there's going to be a way to a solution. There has to be a pathway, an obvious one that we just aren't thinking of, or where people haven't been empowered to move past it. And in the past we have had to, all of us have had to live through wars. It's just that for some of us, it's not in our living memory, unlike what it is for others. So yeah, there's got to be a solution. And I think that just the lack of having our eyes open, the lack of living with it, walking through it like I have done, where I've never really had to think about it before. It's out of my sight. So it's, of course, it's not in my mind. That's just perfectly natural. And so yes, with the power of social media, perhaps, or with learning to stop reporting on things that are going to get clicks and stop having that angle and having avenues where people can truly access this information, be and learn about how volunteering and contributing to something good enriches your life far more than anything you can buy ever will. I think that we can get there, but more people need to be talking about it so that we can find those people who have that spark of genius or that innovation that lays the path down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think traveling to the world, traveling through other cultures, really, it is the best way to learn. I mean, you can't trust everything you read, definitely not what you can see on the TV and on social media. You learned something you never would have learned. I can't relate to what you went through.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like learning how to hike, right? Like, and what being in the wilderness really gives you, and that is really what our natural state is. If you have gone to school and studied and then gone straight into work and you've never taken a holiday and you're just in the grind trying to earn money and the lifestyle that you believe, you know, and if that gives you true joy, then there's nothing wrong with that. But unless you've really lived the alternatives and maybe done a through hike, you can read all you like about it, but you're not going to understand how it affects you until you're out in the arena giving it a go.
In my book, I talk about that you really don't get to learn and understand a place and the people in that place unless you've walked through it.
Mm.
You're not going to learn about a place or its people by driving through it, by going through on a plane or on a bus. You walk through it and you will learn what everything you can.
Yeah, I mean, definitely by you know, I have to acknowledge here that not everyone is going to be able to do what I've done, right? So it's just out of the realm. And yes, I really do think that you can have genuine connections with people and travel to different countries and get an idea, but you will become a part of, you'll have a part of that community settle on you when you walk through it, for sure.
I had visited Vermont, drove through with my car, vacationed there, but I didn't really learn about Vermont and its small towns until I walked it.
Yeah.
And I went into those towns as feeling like a vagabond, right? The stuff in my pack, you know, looking like Nook of the North and smelling like I crawled out of a sewer, and you know, and happy as heck that I was going to sleep in a bed and eat a cooked meal.
Totally. I mean, yeah, the grittier the experience, the more vulnerable you are, maybe the less status you have, you know, when you're coming from the bottom up. These are all things that are going to provide you with a completely different view of the world. And I mean, also, if I could have a ton of cash and know what it's like to be in the upper echelons, I'm sure I'd see the world differently too, and that maybe I might like that a little bit more. Who knows? But I mean, for me at least, the way that I've come to be who I am today, I worked out how much money I need to live, and it's not that much. And I would rather focus on things that are enriching to me and build projects and work with communities to have an effect on their lives, not just one person's, but, you know, a simple bringing a water purifier into a community, something so simple and easy and in my realm of capability, because I can walk in to wherever it is that they live off grid. That will profoundly change the lives of many and give them better health and then perhaps access to education, because they don't have to focus on being in ill health. Or, you know, something so small like the butterfly effect can then ripple out to have a profound effect for years to come. And that's something that I like to think I can contribute to. And enjoy. I mean, more than anything else, it's a selfish thing, because I know that by doing these small acts of kindness to these small communities, enriches my life as well as theirs.
Now, you're still on your journey, but at this point, are you feeling like this has been a life-changing experience so far?
You know, sometimes when I'm just doing my thing, I don't feel like I've changed. I don't feel like I've had a profound epiphany, or there's certainly never been a moment where I've reached the top of a mountain and been like, the meaning of life. Things that I've learned are kind of like, I know that I can't experience the trueness of joy without sharing it with someone, you know, unless there's someone to high five, the weight of it isn't as true. I think definitely it's shaped who I am, but no more than perhaps a different path would have taken me on. But I'm really glad that this is where I'm at. I wouldn't say that it's any less relevant than someone who's a scientist and is developing solutions to climate change or to a medical science issue or any other thing that, you know, I work with geoscientists who help ensure the safety of people who are facing different natural hazard profiles, you know, bushfire and earthquakes, and saving their lives by teaching them how to reinforce their and retrofit their homes. And that's massive. That makes a massive difference and contribution to society. So, yeah, I think that the walk has definitely had its impact on me, but only in the way that life does.
Mm-hmm. Now, on a different note here, I want to talk a little bit about Wombat. Last conversation when you get a chance to, and I wanted to, but tell us about Wombat.
Okay. He's the star of the show. Let me tell you that when I don't post about Wombat, I get many complaints and many messages and many emails. Wombat is a blue heeler, or their true breed name is Australian cattle dog. When I started the expedition, I knew that I wanted to walk with a dog, not just to address my loneliness, but also for my security. It was like a tactile decision, but also one that I knew would be bringing me joy. So once I got past that first year through the expedition, which is the time frame in which most people quit, I knew that I'd proven to myself that it was time that I could commit to a dog and I would be less likely to decide to walk off this expedition and then have a dog to rehome or that I would want to take home with me that was going to cost me a lot of money. So I started looking at street dogs and I had hoped to rescue one, but because of the injuries and mental instability that some of them incur, just with reliability in terms of fear drive and biting and being trainable, I decided it wasn't fair to risk the health of an animal by dragging it across the planet. So I ended up getting a puppy so that I knew if it had been through what it had been through. And so Wombat was named by the community. We had a big voting campaign, which was really beautiful. And he started walking with me when he was a few months old, but by walking with me, if we remember from the last podcast, we were talking about my hiking trailer and he used to hitch a ride on the back. But this breed is a very hard breed to raise. They are bitey, they are stubborn, and they're extremely high energy. So I could let him out of the cart and he'd complain when I put him back in after 5 kilometers because he had energy to burn. But they are fast growing animals and we need to make sure that they don't, you know, cause problems to their joints and muscles at an early age. So we had a constant fight between us about when he could be running free and when he had to go to bed. But when he got older, we had to fight about him being kicked out of the cart because he'd become accustomed to the laziness and luxury and just the general enjoyment of being like having a chariot run by a human. And he's a great dog. He's got an excellent sense of humor. He's fierce. I think some of the biggest things that he's changed is that people fear him because he looks like a wolf and they don't want to risk being bitten. But also when dogs come to bark and bite at me, he chases them off because he is a fierce dog. And he's got a lot of quirks. He's very easily bribed. And the worst thing about him is that unlike most cattle dogs, he loves everybody. If you ask him to sit or do anything that requires authority, he won't listen to you. He'll just pretend that he doesn't speak the language you're speaking. That is true to his breed, but he really loves nothing more than getting a cuddle from someone else. And he is also good at pretending to faint out the front of a restaurant or throw his bowl at a marketeer so that they will fill it up because, you know, this poor dog is being dragged across the planet and must need food.
He's taught to be a good hiker, how to beg for some food or how to subtly get food from strangers.
I never thought that that would be possible, but it is. He has an uncanny way of being gifted food and he is often given food from people and I am not.
Wow, that's funny. And Wombat's going to be staying with you as you continue north?
Yes, he will. He'll do the whole journey with me. And then wherever it is that I end up, he'll be right by my side.
That's great. That's such a good story. So how much longer before you think you're going to be heading back out on the trail?
I'm taking this week off. I'm doing a bunch of podcasts and fun conversations, and I'm also sorting out some logistics and doing what I love, which is rare. I'm having a changeover of equipment, so I'm getting new clothes, which are gonna, it's like nothing feels more of a luxury than being able to slip into a t-shirt that's still soft and fresh. And I'm gonna review my kit, what I have and what I no longer need. And then after that week of rest, I'm continuing forward. And I suspect that in 3 weeks, I'll be in a new country doing it all over again.
Now, Lucy, you have some great YouTubes, great pictures on Instagram. Why don't you tell us all how we can find you on Instagram and on YouTube?
Oh, yeah. So matching with my unruly hair and wombat's tail, my handles are Tangles and Tail. But now if you search Instagram or YouTube for Lucy and Wombat, it will come up under the first search. My YouTube is under my name, Lucy Barnard, but Instagram, I'm more active there, and that's Tangles and Tail.
That's great. And you have a website as well, right?
I do. And sometimes I post blogs. It's been a while, because one thing I didn't expect is that if you walk 40 kilometers a day and start at 3 a.m, it doesn't leave much energy for writing something whimsical and fun for people to read. But it's definitely a nice place to go if you want some background information and just to get some insight into some of the catastrophes that I've had, which are largely due to inexperience.
Well, Lucy, you do a great job of making us all feel like we're a part of your journey, whether it's, you know, something you write or your photos or your YouTubes. And I appreciate you sharing them with everyone. And I encourage everyone to visit them. And we'll put those links in the description for this podcast so everybody can check those out. Lucy Barnard, thank you so much for coming on and sharing all of this with us. And I'm looking forward to talking to you in the future as your journey continues.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to seeing you out there.
Thanks for listening. If you haven't done so yet, go to our website, papabearhikes.com. Listen to past episodes. Check us out on social media. Go to our YouTube channel, Martin Outside. All those links are there. In addition to that, you can buy our book or see what you're missing out on if you're not a Patreon member yet. Remember to get outside, have fun, and be safe. This episode of Papa Bear Hikes has been brought to you by Avalon Publicity. Avalon Publicity, increasing the digital footprint of content creators and skilled professionals via website development and social media services. For more information about Avalon Publicity, go to their website, avalonbusiness.org. That's avalonbusiness.org.